I'd like to ask the speakers to come up, Dr. Goh and Etienne, if you'd come up to the front. And just to provide a little summary where we are while they're coming up, we've looked at increasing food production through careful use of water and aspects of social management slash policy that go with that. We've looked at sub-Saharan Africa and demographic transitions related to birth and aging patterns and the challenge that poverty presents to development under these circumstances. And we looked at resource balances in the Middle East and the management and ramifications of these. So we have a bit of a sense of the interplay of resources, societal structures, and food supply under this, well, with this very august group here. So for the next while, Dr. Alok Adelaya is going to take over and manage the audience in terms of questions. Alok is Director of Biotechnology and Bioresources at TERI, the Energy and Resource Institute in New Delhi. So he could hardly be more appropriate. He's here with us today for just to chair this session. So here we go.
Thank you. Yeah. We had three very exciting presentations, and I think there's a tremendous possibility of enthused audience looking for questions and some clarifications. So I will open this session for question answers. And if there is, and they can introduce themselves and ask their speaker with whom they want to ask the question.
So my name is Jade Chong Smith, and I'm a fourth year undergrad with the McGill School of Environment. So this question's mainly for the first speaker, but perhaps the others could offer their insight as well. So given China's water scarcity issues and the increasing demand of non-agricultural water uses, does it make sense for China to continue its policy aims of achieving grain self-sufficiency? Will improving efficiency and irrigation and water-saving technology be enough? Or should China consider decreasing grain production and looking outward to import more grain from more water-rich countries? And then what would the implications be for the international food system?
Thank you. Very good question. As mentioned, China is a country with a large population. If we import grain or cereals, so it have a serious impact on world food market. So I think in 2008, during the financial crisis and also high food prices time, China changed the policy. Previously, we think only 90% of food self-sufficient is enough. But after that, we increased this figure to 95%. Actually, last year, this figure reached 200%. In China, we think if average cereal holding reached to 400 kilograms per person per year, that's reached the food security. So for the future, in China, we have to totally depend on increased cereal production in China, not international market. For water, it's a good question. Here we have a serious water shortage problem. Now we try to modernize irrigation scheme, try to increase water efficiency and productivity. We have huge potential to do that. And also we can save some water and return to natural system for good water and land conservation. Thank you.
Okay. Next question.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Lynn Holguin, and I'm the policy director in Oxfam Quebec. Oxfam Quebec is a development and humanitarian organization, and we support small farmers in many countries in Africa, Latin America, and Asia. Thank you very much for your presentation, and I will address my question to Professor Heinzelin. I really appreciate the fact that you talk about the small farmers and the need for investment in small farmers and family farming. I would like to hear your opinion regarding women farmers. As you know, most of the small farmers that we're talking about are women, And so what are the, in your opinion, what are the actions that need to be taken to guarantee, to ensure that women's farmers, their rights are ensured and that we are supported and the policies are implemented so we reach them? And my second question, again to you, Professor, is regarding the donor support that is right now to create this public-private partnership. In the G8 in May 2012, there was this announcement of the new alliance where there is this promotion of the investment in agriculture by the private sector. And there is a pilot in 6 African countries. But if we look at the countries that being piloted are not necessarily the poorest in Africa. So your opinion in this public-private partnership and the push for more investment from the private sector in increasing agriculture production in Africa. Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Okay. Thank you for the question. About women, obviously, there is not one simple situation across African countries. Its situation is particular, but obviously everybody knows that women are a key actor in, not only in farming, but also in marketing, transforming, and street restaurants in many different places of Africa. One of the conclusions of this study, Rural Struc, that we've made with the FIDA and World Bank, was there was an extreme urgency to reinvest in regional strategic vision of development and to reconnect a sectoral thinking about agriculture production development and rural area development. And one of the means is to have what we call a public policy production process with the population. And if this happens, obviously women will be heard much more than they are now. So this is extremely important that all the stakeholders, not only in the farming, but also the whole rural area economics, can build together a project of development themselves. The second point I want to make is that this is not only in farming that women are important. They are very important, and they're not very frequently met in scientific research, in technical services. So there are programs that are trying to rehabilitate and to promote women to get into agriculture science and to get into agriculture technical services. And I think it is very promising in some countries that are pushing that.
I must mention that we have more women in this room than the men.
Is that encouraging? My name is Felix von Geyer. I'm a sustainable development journalist. The first lady actually took about 80% of my questions, so congratulations. I was talking to the Dalai Lama last September about the importance of the Tibetan plateau, because when China took Tibet, it knew full well that the Tibetan plateau was the water source for then about 1 billion people in sort of Southeast Asia, and now 2 billion people. And it's already diverting the water from the Tibetan plateau up to northern China, not just for agricultural purposes, but for industrial mining purposes as well. What's the effect of that going to be in terms of agriculture in South Asia when you actually kind of get this hydrological loss, basically? And also, what responsibility do relatively water-rich countries like Canada, which has about 6.5% of the world's renewable water resources, what responsibility does that have to actually provide virtual water in terms of products, whether they be industrial products or providing, say, wheat to Jordan? How do we get a strategy, an export strategy around these types of things? Thank you.
So, as I mentioned, I'm not a politician. So, for what I can only answer water issue. So, As I mentioned, you know, in China, we totally depend on increased water efficiency and productivity. We do have water transfer project from South China to North China, but it's at the downstream of Yangtze River, not at the upstream. So I think that's the water transfer, interbasin transfer, and also have we carry out a lot of feasibility study for the water transfer from South China to North China. It's expensive for agriculture sector, but it's only used for industry and domestic sector. But in this way, agriculture sector can keep the water for agriculture products. Otherwise, you know, industry sector and the domestic sector, they can pay high price and can easily get water from agriculture sector. That's my answer. Thank you.
Sorry. Hi. My name is David Chen. I'm a first year in International Agriculture and Food Systems here at McGill. My question is for Professor Hazelin. From what I understand, part of your solution or part of your projects is a modernization of the agricultural system in sub-Saharan Africa without necessarily the mechanization that loses jobs. So you're keeping more jobs in rural sectors by having less mechanization. And my question is that by having those jobs, is there a concern that it will cause the workforce to be stuck in jobs that are low skill and low wage, or is it more just, and do you have anything that, do you have strategies that mitigate that, or is it more an issue of it's better to have a job than none at all?
Thank you for the question. I have no recipe for this problem. I just wanted to resize the challenge of jobs in sub-Saharan Africa. But what I can tell you is that there are a huge wealth of different pathways of intensification, from the most conventional with mechanization and motorization and oil use, intensive oil use, to many other pathways. What I'm just advocating is that we have to confront, to challenge intensification pathways to the job questions. Now, about the income, I think that what is appearing from our study is that the extreme poverty level of the farmers don't allow them to diversify their income. But as soon as, many people said that this morning, as you make the productivity grow with intensification pathways that preserve jobs, you can start to diversify your income with transformation products. But there are conditions for that. Obviously, there are a very strong public policy priority for small farming. And second, you have to build markets that are viable for small farmers, which is not the case today. We have to build these local and regional markets and to reconnect that to development projects. But obviously, I'm dreaming, like everybody here, that the income from agriculture will not be misery income. I'm dreaming that it's going to start a process of development of diversification of income.
I've been very encouraged by the speakers, particularly the gentleman from CIRAD, talking about this issue of intensification, and also the emphasis being given throughout the day on smallholder farmers. We've known for a long time that if we invest in the production system of smallholder farmers, that it's possible to realize what has long been stated to be the inverse relationship between farm size and per hectare productivity. But this is not new information, with all due respect. But on the other hand, if we look at countries including our own here in Canada, that we still find that the model of agriculture development that is promoted, including in some of our aid and trade programs, is based on modernization that will do exactly, and in my view, what you have said. It will mechanize and displace and evict people from the rural sector. So my question isn't whether the logic that's been presented is sound, But what needs to be done to have this information and the evidence in support of this style of development better taken up by policymakers? Because with few exceptions, including in the multilateral system, are we seeing this being taken up as a strong force? It is a force that sometimes is still hidden behind all of the infrastructure and other ways in which we still see a bias toward commercial agriculture. So it's more, I think the issue is not a technical issue. It's well grounded in what we've been hearing today and have heard elsewhere. The question is, why are we not being able to effect public policy in the same direction? This seems to be where the major obstacle rests.
Thank you. I agree with you. There is, I think, one of the reasons is the strong misunderstanding of what is family agriculture. A strong misunderstanding. Family agriculture, it's not exactly the same meaning as smallholders. There is a notion of patrimonial management that makes the farmer rooted in the territory and rooted in clusters of development, of local development, which is kind of different from smallholders. France, Europe is 99% of family agriculture. United States is 95% of family agriculture in that sense. It's not only the size, it's also the way of management with the manpower of the family and the patrimonial management. So I think what makes the policy difficult to build, to protect this kind of agriculture, I think it's the model we have in mind, the misunderstanding of what is family agriculture, what is intensification. For 30 years, the average budget share of African countries to agriculture was around 3%. So there is an increase now. It's coming back to the agenda, and they're going to invest a lot in agriculture. But historically, they have been completely despised for three decades. So it's coming back. But now it's going to be very difficult to intensify with inclusiveness and sustainability. Just these figures of jobs, Mali will have to create by 25, 5 million of jobs, which is enormous when you know Mali, with 3 million of jobs in rural area. So there will be an incredible pressure on the land, an incredible pressure on intensification. But the only way to start a virtuous circle of development is to take out of the poverty trap the farmers that are now in poverty trap. Most of them in our survey of the 8,000 households in these countries, we could compare successful regions and very difficult regions. In some regions, most of them are much poorer than all the statistics we showed before. Less than $1 a day, most of them in Mali.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to address the first speaker first, and then perhaps I want to make some comments for the general session. In China, you did say that the productivity and also to predict what's going to happen in the 2050. So you focused on the production side of things. So now I know from the Indian situation, the government always has policies to build up the buffer stock for the grains and cereals, just in case if the weather failure and of those things would happen, then the government is still have enough grains to feed to the people. I was interested in knowing what is the policy in China about the buffer stocks. And then as soon as you talk about this, then one has to talk about the losses associated with it. Could you please comment on that?
So I do not have the actual figure, but I think in China, as I mentioned, we have a national grain reservation program. So in the good year, government just collect grain with a certain price. If the price is lower than that, government just buy the grains from farmer at that price. In the poor year, government just use more storage. I think these figures very high, but I cannot tell you exact figure right now. I think it's very good policy. But as also mentioned by other speakers, we have some losses. You know, the losses during the transport and the storage that also has to be handled. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If I may, I would like to make some comments about it. Since the percentage of the population involved in primary agriculture, also the job situation in the sub-Saharan area. So I would like to look at things the way it was in the Asian context and the American context. Certainly, if you go back to 1950s and 60s, the percentage of population involved in primary agriculture was quite large. So slowly we moved on to the mechanization, and 30 years ago it used to be like 4 to 5% of the population involved in primary agriculture. Then today we are talking about 2, 3% of the people involved. So therefore the mechanization and technology input has definitely contributed to have big time production, so that you could supply that to the population. Now when you look at the Asian and the African situation, if I take numbers with respect to India, for instance, you're talking about 650 million people involved in primary agriculture. Although the economic growth is on that side, but then those 650 million people are the ones who go to the job to do their work and then get the livelihood of it. But then the things that is produced, then it always gets value added. And that value added part is going to be benefited by the other parts of the society where the farmer is left cold. So therefore, the structure that the Indian policymakers are looking into, how to bring those jobs at the village level so that the value addition and the job creation should happen in those kind of situation. And then I think when I look at the numbers as far as the growth rate is concerned from the African situation, I think the youngsters, when they don't have the job, then the agriculture needs to be integrated quite well so that the mechanization doesn't have to happen big time immediately, but then the laborers that is available can have the educational programs which can help to fill the gap for the farmers at the village level. Thereby, you have the job created as well as slowing down the mechanization or that part of it so that the problem of the job as well as supplying the necessary labor that is required to have the production increase so that it becomes semi-sustainable in the situation that we are looking at. So I think that is one of the important things to look at when you have the agricultural productivity and then the people involved in that. I think that framework needs to be looked at from the historical perspective and transform that into the different geographic region as we have all of these information available both from the historical perspective and the current technological development that you would have. I like to say that if you have any questions, I can answer them.
Thank you.
Tim Johns from School of Dietetics and Human Nutrition at McGill. I'd like to further our discussion about transformation of smallholder farmers, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but I think also thinking about it in the context of third speakers and looking at global cereal markets. But Dr. Aislinn, you put an emphasis on smallholder farmers increasing their productivity or their production of cereals in particular. And I just wonder, in terms of projection, in terms of global production of cereals, of prices of cereals in the future, of our cereal needs, what models is that based on? Certainly, there will be pressures on cereals, but the lessons of the past is that smallholder farmers don't compete very well. They get undercut by global intensified production of cereals, and producing cereals is sort of, for many of them, and most of them, is a recipe for staying in poverty. You have mentioned other diversification, but in your talk here, you put a strong emphasis on cereals.
I think it depends very much on the country we're speaking about. If you take Senegal, which is very dependent on importation of rice, the case is completely different in Cerro. The case is completely different in Cameroon, which the staple is plantain and cassava, mainly. So the dependency to the global market is different. But my point is that it's obvious during the three last decades, with the despise to the small agriculture, that the small agriculture had to compete with the global market on some products, specifically cereal. And so they couldn't compete and they disappeared at a great rate. So the question is that if you want to deal with big numbers, with the big numbers of jobs involved, you have to take big steps in terms of policy. And obviously the model is to prepare the market to be able to compete, to prepare the small farmers to be able to compete. And otherwise, the urban demand of food will be taken by the global market, and which is be a catastrophe for small farmers. Sorry. So my point is that you have to imagine policy of protection at regional level of kind of buffering tools to let the farmers be able to intensify and to be able to increase their competitivity progressively, not to put in the global market right away. So that's the problem. Now, in terms of technical intensification, there is no silver bullet in that. The difference is that we know very well the conventional intensification with fertilizer, pesticides, and sometimes mechanization. We know the good point of that is very easy to increase the yield. We know also the bad sides of it, impact. But we don't know much about other kinds of intensification, and which is very dependent on the location. So the paradigm of technical pathways for intensification is from a one-fits-for-all conventional intensification to a diversification of pathways built up by the communities. It might be kind of a dream, but in a sense, there are many examples in sub-Saharan African countries where some steps of intensification, improvement of yield, have happened in the past.
So even with rice and with maize in sub-Saharan Africa, which is so important, that there are policies that should be put in place that would lead to greater competitiveness of smallholder farmers.
Corn is in the countries where they eat a lot of corn, for example, Malawi. There is a controversial policy that was subsidizing fertilizer that led Malawi to pass from a net importer to a net exporter of corn in a few years. But it costs a lot of money. But I think there are other kind of policy that help the farmers to organize their local market and regional markets, even for cereal. Yeah, even for cereal. And Prabhu this morning mentioned the investment in research for small cereals like millet, like sorghum, and this is also the local farmers have a comparative advantage for these cereals for the local markets, I think.
Hi, my name is Caroline Begg. I'm from the Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences, and this is directed to Eckhard Wurtz. Do you see or believe that there's any sort of conflict or problem with promoting countries to certain countries who are in developing countries to commercialize or export a lot of agriculture and also the virtual water movement at the same time? Because if we go back to the talk this morning where it was to maybe we shouldn't keep subsidizing North American and European agriculture, we should actually then promote developing countries to do what they do best is agriculture, but that is then the movement of virtual water. And I'm just wondering what your comments are on that sort of movement.
To promote commercialization of agriculture in like sub-Saharan Africa, you mean?
Yes.
I mean, why not? I wouldn't say that there is not a possibility of win-win outcomes. Yeah, they are not happening right now either because the projects are not well designed or because they are not taking place at all. But for example, Sudan, yes, it's close to the Gulf countries. Yes, they could produce certain crops that are in high demand in the Gulf, not necessarily wheat because they do not really have the climate for that, but for example fruits or vegetables, and they are in need of income generation. And in these high value-added crops, yes, there is also much more space for smallholder farmers than in cereal production where mechanization is, I guess, a necessity to be competitive. In order to export virtual water, of course, it means you need to have it. Yeah.
Yes.
Now, sub-Saharan Africa, yes, has only an economic water shortage. Pakistan, Central Asia, they have kind of the same problems like the Gulf countries, right? They have a physical water shortage, and it's not getting better with climate change, especially in Pakistan with the melting of Himalaya glaciers. So the Punjab might be able, basically the ability of the Indus Valley to create food might decrease by about 25 million people, is this estimate by Immersal. But in Africa it's a bit of a different ball game, although it would be different crops than are demanded in the Middle East. So as I've said, the Middle East, the Gulf countries look very much for alfalfa production in East Africa. What I see so far, especially in Sudan, completely crazy project designs. They tell you with a straight face that they will produce wheat on 1.5 million hectares with water from the West Nubian sandstone aquifer, and tell you with steadfast conviction that this is renewable water, which it is not. It is fossil water, like in Saudi Arabia. Yes, the Nile waters with all these dams that are constructed at the worst possible place where you can construct the dam. Yeah, like the Merowe Dam, the evaporation rates are about 7 times higher than in Ethiopia. But with these dams, Sudan will max out its allocation quota of the 59 treaty for the first time. So there is not that much water left afterwards to basically create the crops and to export virtual water then. Yeah? So kind of sustainable intensification will be very important going ahead.
Sorry, this is last minute, so it might be a little rough. I'm Dara, I'm a University of Ottawa student. And I'm just wondering, I guess this is directed slightly at Wirtz, and Hainsland touched on this a little bit, so thanks. You talked about how without fertilizers, we could maybe feed 3 billion people at the most. How do we reconcile the need for increased production of food when we are starting to understand all of the damage done to the environment by over-fertilizing and putting too much nitrogen into the soils and stuff like that? And is there a way, do you think, for us to come up with sustainable agriculture, as in alternative methods of agriculture that aren't just filling the land with fertilizer to produce higher numbers of crops? Do you think that there's a way to kind of diversify crop growth and stuff like that in these places that need to increase their productivity?
Well, I mean, Keynes once said, in the long run, we are all dead. Yeah. So, yes, I agree with you. There are huge problems, no doubt about that. At the same time, we have to see that this huge productivity or in production explosion that we have witnessed since the Second World War, and that has accommodated this population growth, was only possible because of fertilizers. And I'm not an agronomist, I'm referring here to Václav Smil and his book Enriching the Earth, and he had an estimate in 2001 that without nitrogen fertilizer only, or with purely organic agriculture, only about 60% of the world population could be fed. I don't know. He seems to be a very respectable figure and makes a convincing case. Yeah, maybe there are others criticizing it. What seems to be one issue that is rarely discussed, I mean, we are using about two-thirds of land for meat production, yeah? Apart from biofuels, that is, I think, the most obvious way how we could tackle the issue from the demand side, and it's never been done yet. I mean, this kind of dietary change is always basically portrayed as a God-given. Yes, and I think that's very obvious that with a plant-based diet you could feed many more people. It doesn't mean that we all need to become vegetarians, but I think it's not necessarily or shouldn't be necessarily a goal that we eat basically three times a day meat and seven days a week. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. There are a lot of prospective work about the equation of feeding 9 million people, obviously. CIRAD and INRA made one called AgriMonde with assumption of these other intensification pathways to see what would be the impact in terms of lands, in terms of obviously, when you consider, for example, agroecological intensification, you accept low yield to get a lower impact on the environment. So then you need more lands to grow things, obviously. But at the same time, I agree with my colleague here, many times the equation was studied in details for supply side and not very much for the demand side. And the questioning about the meat consumption, and recently there are a lot of research going out about desperdition of food. The amount of desperdition of food, we speak about 40% of the food in Canada lost at different stage of the consumption. So we have to challenge also the demand side to be able to make a reflection on the equation. But obviously, if you want to combine the trade-off between the need for production, the need to reduce impact, the need to reconfigure the food demand, you manage. I think there is no technical problem to feed the world. The problem is more how, I would say from my presentation, how do this feeding business, production business, transformation business, is taken as an opportunity of business for the most of the people and the farmers and all the rural area economic cluster that have to be protected and nurtured by policies to be able to cope with that. Because obviously it's going to be easy to install huge farm, mechanized farm in Africa, and produce the quantity we need. But then the social impact will be tremendous. So there is a reflection to be done about the model of intensification. It's not one against the other. They can live together. And for some products, it's going to be more interesting in terms of environment and market to do that on large scales. But obviously, the social impact has to be measured.
Okay.
So just add a few words. So you raise a very important issue. Overuse of fertilizer is very popular in some countries like China, especially for smallholders. We talk about water user efficiency is very low, but for the fertilizers, much low, only maybe 30%. That means 70% of fertilizer applied leads to surface water body or to groundwater. So currently, so we try to increase not only water user efficiency, but also fertilizer efficiency, try to apply water at the fertilizer together, like we adopt drip irrigation system, can irrigate and use fertilizer together. So in China, we discuss about, you know, in South China, we have more water. But for drip system, also adopt quickly in South China. That's not for the purpose of water saving, but for the purpose of increase fertilizer using efficiency. That can also solve the pollution problem, no source, no pot pollution source problem. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, my name is Jenna Senecal, and I'm a bioresource student at McDonald campus. My research is looking at using human urine as a fertilizer, and it works. So I think we should be talking more about some of the alternatives to synthetic fertilizer, but I have a general question. If you look around, most of us are pretty young here, and we're here because we're scared about the future. And so I think I'm talking for myself, but I think it can be generalized. We're here for action as well. We want to know what sort of things we can do in order to improve the things for the future. So I was wondering if anyone has any inputs on what can our age group do in order to make things better. Thank you.
Any of you? Oh, yeah. Plenty of things to say. I want to give a list, a catalog of things you should do. Obviously, I think most of you are not farmers, I guess. Most of you are scientific. And I think we need a lot of science, but at the same time, we don't need too much science. What I mean by that is that farmers have to make their own transformation decision. And this is extremely important. Science is one ingredient, but it's not the only ingredient. And that's the first point. The second point, as scientists from northern country, most of you, you will have to want to solve problems in southern countries, which is not that quite right. Imagine Sudanese scientists coming here to survey the pig farmers in Quebec and trying to get the figures of their production and phosphorus input, etc. It's extremely difficult. So what I would suggest for your generation is to promote scientific sovereignty from the southern country to be able to cope with their own problem and to build partnership that make that happen.
Another question from me, both directed to Dr. Wirtz and Dr. Ainslie. Dr. Wirtz, you mentioned that in talking about food security in the Middle East, that there's a connection with African situation as well. When you look at sub-Saharan Africa and increasing productivity, Africa already exports a lot of food around the world. So increasing production can really end up for export markets rather than benefiting sub-Saharan Africa as well. And a situation like Sudan going to the Middle East would suggest that. In Kenya, you're probably well aware that increasingly there's a large meat export market, particularly coming out of the northeast, which are the unstable areas of the country that are probably sucking meat out of Sudan, which is one of the most food insecure worlds. Areas of the world as well already. So when we're thinking of it in terms of conflict, the patterns that we see would seem to pit sub-Saharan Africa against other regions and lead to shifting conflict out of some area and moving it down into another one.
So I'm not sure where your question is aiming at exactly. So whether it's a good idea to for the Gulf countries to invest at all,
well,
or
with our,
in which way they destabilize governments or
well,
societies.
Yeah, what's good for the Gulf is one thing. Yeah. I'm looking at it from a global perspective. And if we're concerned about potential for conflict and how to mediate conflict, then clearly that type of situation that takes meat resources from a population where meat is in desperate supply in terms of from a nutritional point of view and basic food security or other examples like that, on a global perspective, that seems to be to have potential for as many negatives or more negatives than positive. And whatever the Gulf should do is one, but on a global scale, are there ways that we should be mediating that potential for damage and for conflict?
I mean, the main meat suppliers of live animals in the region are Syria, Iran, and above all, Australia. Yeah. There are some supplies from Somalia and Sudan to the Gulf. But while they might play a considerable role in these respective countries or to provide income or maybe also to destabilize communities in that region, for the Gulf, as a whole, it doesn't really play that much of a role here. Basically, the contribution of African countries to Gulf food imports is really minuscule. Yeah? You can hardly see it in the statistics. There has been a destabilizing effect, for example, in 1984, 85, ahead of the famine, and at a time where the Gulf countries had already started or tried to develop Sudan as a breadbasket in the 1970s as a reaction to these threats of a counter-embargo to the Arab oil boycott. There was a pretty destabilizing effect, not of the investments themselves, because most of the time they didn't take off, or as far as they took off, like the Kenana Sugar Company, they were not profitable, at least at that time. In terms of Gulf countries and buyers, especially the Faisal Islamic Bank, buying up the sorghum crop of Sudan, yeah, and kind of cornering the market. At one time, these Islamic banks that were also basically got a lot of privileges from the Sudanese government side, and a lot of cronyism going on, cornered about 40% of the sorghum market, and a parallel proposal to build up a storage facility ahead of the famine basically did not succeed. Yeah, in that case, we clearly had a destabilizing effect without even having direct land investments or whatever, simply basically buying up the crops that would have been needed for storage. And over a whole five-year period ahead of the famine, production in Sudan was not lower than during other prolonged periods. Yeah, so with better management, this famine and of course more empowerment of disadvantaged population segments, this famine could have been prevented. But as you might know, the whole Sudan issue is basically since the 19th century that a northern elite in the mainly based in Sudan in Khartoum is dominating and exploiting the rest of the country, yeah, in the south and in Darfur as well. So yes, on the surface it's a conflict and whatever between different ethnic groups or religious groups, but at the end of the day it boils down to this, and this whole sorghum story and the story of Faisal Islamic Bank is just one aspect of that.
I mean, it seems, you know, what benefits some people has negative impacts on others. And the fact that Saudi Arabia, maybe insignificant the amount of meat that's coming out of East Africa from a Saudi Arabia point of view, but it is significant in East Africa, and in Kenya, for instance, it benefits small producers. But if you look at the global food budget for the, you know, for the country as a whole, from a nutritional point of view, one would have to see it as a negative. But it's certainly significant from a Kenyan point of view, if not from a Saudi Arabian point of view.
I mean, you know, like in Sudan, a lot of the livestock production is not commercial, and the takeout rates of the herds are very low. You know, there's also a lot of social prestige attached to large herds. You know, they are used as payment for dowries and so on. But from an economic point of view, commercialization would be good, and I think it might also provide desperately needed income, because my feeling is that there's nothing to be romanticized about subsistence farming in Sudan, yeah, and it is on its way out anyway. So the question is basically how you can transform it in some form of socially equitable manner, or whether it takes this usual Sudanese way that is then often associated with a lot of cruelty and even genocide.
Well, I think the last.
Yes, this is just in response to what Monsieur Belmaya said before about farmers playing a role too. In the room, we are at least a couple of farmers here. I myself come from a farm in Quebec. And for farmers, for me and what I see in the industry, for farmers to produce food sustainably, the government has to have direct action in the industry. A farm is a business. We're looking to make money. And if there's no regulations, the way about going around that is very possible in many cases. It will not be sustainable. And to create a good environment for farming to thrive, the government should be involved and create good measures to make a good market, marketing opportunities, and a good environment for business.
Yeah. No, I think the last comment was absolutely pertinent from the point of view that there has to be a top-down and bottom-up approach where food and politics have to meet and have to look at the dimensions globally. Because if we look at globe, we have definitely a problem in terms of food production, the food safety, and issues related to climate change and impacts. There are several other issues, for example, post-harvest losses in many, many developing countries. We lose a lot, though we produce as well. And that's an area where a tremendous amount of assistance and the politics can play a very significant role. Soil fertility impacts losses are also another issue which is emerging, not only in developing countries, but also in developed countries. And technology penetration is another issue. The technology penetration have serious positive impacts as well as several negative impacts as well. There is an issue of sustainability. There is an issue of maintaining sustainable production systems in a manner where the entire ecosystem also remains in balance. The knowledge transfer in developing countries is an issue. The means of transfer of knowledge becomes a critical factor. And one need to look at the issues of taking knowledge at the end of the value chain where the farmers are operating on farmers' field. The developed world is facing problems of trade deficit from the produce coming from the farmland. And there are issues of conflicts between the subsidies provided by developing countries and the pricing which is emerging. At the end, I think what emerge that the resource use efficiency is a key which we must address. And if resource use efficiency is achieved at the maxima, I think many issues can be handled very easily. So with these words, I would like to thank Chair for giving me the opportunity for having this very enriching discussion. And I would like to thank the excellent three speakers for not only providing us the insight on the issues that they talked about, but also providing us in-depth response to the questions that raised by the audience.
And just before we go, I'd like to thank Dr. Adelaide for offering to be co-chair. Thank you very much. Please join us.